Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Monica Attard.
There's been a dramatic escalation in tensions between Russia's military and the Wagner mercenary group, raising fears it could lead to a civil war in Russia. Wagner's founder, Yevgeny Prigozhin, claims his troops have crossed the border back into Russia from Ukraine. The Wagner Group describes itself as a private military company and has been fighting alongside the Russian army in Ukraine for more than a year. But tensions between these private mercenaries and the Russian military have been simmering, with the boss of the Wagner Group accusing Russia's defence minister of incompetence. Now that tension has risen considerably.
За наш суверенитет и независимость, за право быть и оставаться Россией, государством с тысячелетней историей. Эта битва, когда решается судьба нашего народа, требует единения всех сил, единства, консолидации и ответственности.
Let's go ahead and take a live look outside at Moscow, Russia. We do have this live look today. This is the site of a lot of action yesterday as the Wagner Group started making their way to Moscow, but they were deterred at some point. Some kind of deal was made between Putin and the Wagner Group. So we'll go to that story here. That armed rebellion in Russia ended after that deal yesterday. We do have Fox's Alex Hogan. She has the latest details out of London.
Well, it's been an astounding few days if you follow Russia, the war in Ukraine, and of course, the Russian President Vladimir Putin. On Saturday came news that Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of the infamous private military provider, the Wagner Group, was, depending on your sources, attempting a coup or a mutiny or was having a huge dummy spit. After seizing the cities of Rostov-on-Don and Voronezh, and with his forces just 200 kilometres from Moscow, Prigozhin called the whole show off, turned his soldiers around and headed back in the direction of Ukraine. A deal had been struck by the Belarusian president, which would see Wagner set up base on the territory of Russia's closest ally, and more curiously, Prigozhin walking away having been accused of treason by one man you'd never want to be accused of treason by, Putin. So why did Prigozhin do it? And what does this actually mean for the Russian president? Also, did our media let us down with simplistic analysis that suddenly turned Prigozhin into a good guy, which he certainly is not? To help us talk about all of this, we're lucky to be joined by Russian journalist Leonid Rogozin. Rogozin is based in Riga in Latvia. He's a freelance journalist who's previously worked for the BC. He's also just written a book on the shadowy groups behind the information wars, which have dominated the war between Russia and Ukraine. Lena, welcome to Fourth Estate. Thank you for being back on the show. The war in Ukraine is now well into its second year. The death toll on both sides is, you know, enormous. When you heard that Yevgeny Prigozhin and his troops were trying to take the Russian city of Rostov-on-Don, what was your first reaction to the news?
Well, it was pretty shocking. It did sound like a potential start of a civil war in Russia. And we, of course, know that Wagner Group is one of the most formidable units in the Russian armed forces. So when it transpired that they are mutineering and that they are taking a major population center in the south of Russia, which itself is the most densely populated part of Russia, it felt very worrying because, of course, Russia is not just another country. It's a nuclear superpower. So any disturbances on that scale inside Russia is an issue not just for Russia itself, but for entire humanity.
Did you think that he was actually attempting a coup? That's what he had in mind? Or did you think it was mutiny? Or did you think that, you know, as I did, I have to say that just he hysterically misjudged the level of support that he had from the Russian president?
Well, look, when it all started, it wasn't clear at all what it is. And it did look like a coup attempt from what he was saying, from how he defied the president after Putin made his initial speech and called him plainly a mutineer and said that what was happening was an act of treason. But Prigozhin proceeded with the march of Moscow towards Moscow at that point. So yeah, initially it did look like coup d'etat. In hindsight, now it looks more like a show of force, or as Prigozhin himself put it, a protest, a kind of a desperate gesture of a person who was about to lose his army. The defense ministry insisted that members of Wagner Group signed contracts with the Russian army by July the 1st was the deadline for Wagner to essentially to cease to exist. And what Prigozhin, I think, was trying to do is to demonstrate that he's commanding a formidable force, that he potentially could create a lot of trouble. But again, from what he was saying, this was not an attempt to topple Putin. He never during the 24 hours of his mutiny said that the intention is to change the government. He insisted on removing his two main enemies, the defense minister Sergei Shoigu and the chief of the general staff, Valery Gerasimov. So these were his stated goals.
Yes. So, and of course, that dispute has been going on for so long between he and the defense minister. One of the things that I've wondered about is whether this was simply really at the end of the day a case of the Russian president not really doing his job very well, because Putinism relies on feuding factions within the various verticals of power. And what Putin has been very good at doing for the past 20 years has been quelling any disputes in order to, you know, maintain his own power base. Is this a simple case that he didn't intervene sooner in the dispute between Shoigu and Prigozhin and it got to this point?
Well, we don't know yet. The question really is whether Prigozhin is acting as an independent, autonomous figure, as a party in this dispute, or is he presenting faction within the Kremlin, which somehow precipitated his mutiny. So there are signs that he might be representing such a faction. And that's essentially the younger generation of military leaders who want the war in Ukraine to be waged in a different way, in a more, I would say, brutal way, but also in the way that involves swathes of the Russian population. They want a more mobilization. They want the Russian army to be more proactive on the front line and to be more brutal, more cruel in relation to Ukraine and to the civilian population in Ukraine. So these people are represented to a large extent by the many Telegram channels, which where openly promoting and are still openly promoting certain political figures as potential candidates for the position of the defense minister. And one of them is Sir Alexei Dumin, the governor of Tula, who was Putin's former bodyguard and who played a mysterious but probably very important role in the occupation of Crimea in 2014, perhaps as the commander of the special forces under the Russian military intelligence, the GRU. But that remains a state secret, and he has been denying his role. But all we know about him that he's not a mayor, governor, but a high-level fixer, a person who solves delicate problems for Putin. So, yep.
You'd have to think, though, that if Putin was going to make a move on Shoigu, that wouldn't be for quite some time. He won't want to be seen as giving in to the demands of Yevgeny Prigozhin.
No, absolutely. If the removal of Shoigu or Asimov is part of the deal, then perhaps a way for Putin to not lose face in the process is also part of the deal. So the fact that Shoigu is not departing from his post immediately after the mutiny doesn't mean that he will not lose his post in the near future. However, Putin made a point about saying that the Russian defense minister played the key role in repelling the mutiny and suppressing the mutiny. So it's not quite clear whether Shoigu is going to go or not. The intrigue is still unfolding within the Kremlin And also the negotiations between the Russian government and Prigozhin are probably still continuing. There is the question of the heavy weapons and military hardware that Prigozhin was supposed, according to the Russian Defense Ministry, to hand over to the ministry. However, this heavy equipment has been transferred to Belarus, to Prigozhin's new base in another country. So it's not clear if that is happening. But also it's very likely that there are political negotiations between parties and figures we are not aware of. The impact of this mutiny on the shape of the Russian government is yet to transpire, and it will probably take days or weeks or even months before we know what is going to happen.
And presumably also it will take days, weeks, and months before anybody can say whether it has significantly or even, you know, to any extent weakened Putin, I imagine.
No, exactly. And the main question is whether it was the initiative of Prigozhin and his immediate entourage. And in that case, it really is a desperate gesture by a person who was about to lose his business and his friends and partners who were about to lose their autonomy and freedom inside this private army. So that's, of course, a possibility. The Fort Wagner group is this deniable force, very much modeled on Blackwater in the United States. And it enjoyed some grade of autonomy at the same time, as Putin admitted yesterday. It was entirely on the Russian government payroll. But there were precedents in the world history when governments had issues with mercenaries. And even in this war, after the start of the war in 2014, the Ukrainian government had to rein in some of the volunteer forces. The Ukrainian armed forces had to blockade bases of the Red Sector and of Azov at some point in order to coerce these volunteer forces into being properly incorporated into the Ukrainian armed forces. And they kind of succeeded, but this success is also a compromise because both of these forces continue to enjoy a great deal of autonomy, both operational autonomy and ideological autonomy.
So, Leonard, I want to get into the interesting murky area of information, because there's been so much misinformation, not only around the war and its conduct, but on Saturday it seemed to be, you know, misinformation seemed to be on steroids, particularly on social media and Twitter in particular. There were so many analysts out there who were giving their opinions that Putin was being torn down by a military faction, that this was tantamount to a coup, that Putin would now have 1 to 2 months maximum left in power if that had Prigozhin actually reached Moscow, he would have succeeded. You would have been seeing roughly the same Twitter feed that I was. What were you making of it all?
Well, first of all, of course, I don't think that this events signify the an imminent downfall of Putin's regime. It is, of course, a serious event. But again, as I said before, it is not clear whether it reflects a fight for power within the Kremlin, as Russians say, a battle of Kremlin's towers, or it was a mutiny of this autonomous deniable force that was used by the Russian army. And it happened just because they were too autonomous, and it's kind of inevitable conflict between the regular army and those irregulars. But the way they managed to travel several hundred kilometers, and they claim that they came to the distance of about 200 kilometers away from Moscow. Reports confirm that they managed to reach the town of Yelets, which is 400 kilometers away from Moscow. So it's not clear whether their claim is true. But yes, if it were not Wagner troops, a Wagner group, but a foreign army, say Ukrainian army, then swathes of the Russian territory would have been occupied and the battle would have been waged on the approaches to Moscow. That does make the Russian defense lines, the home defense, look quite weak and vulnerable. So it does matter. But on the other hand, I think what is most important in Putin's calculation is, and the reason why Putin remains in power, is that he protects people, or he projects an image of somebody who is protecting Russian people from exactly that, from civil war. And at the end of the day, the fact that he did not start a military operation against Wagner troops somewhere in Rostov region or somewhere close to Moscow, but instead he chose the path of negotiations. In the eyes of the Russian public, it doesn't necessarily show him as somebody who is weak. It shows him as somebody who was clever enough and responsible enough not to start a civil war in Russia. And again, the fact that he needed foreign president Alexander Lukashenko to negotiate, it on the one hand, it kind of shows that Putin is not capable of dealing with this situation on his own. But from the viewpoint of the Russian public, and indeed the Russian propaganda is going to present it in this way, what Putin was doing is again, averting Putin's civil war.
Which is a really interesting, that's a really interesting aspect of it, because that is, as you say, that is going to be the line of Russian propaganda. And it's likely, I imagine, to be reasonably successful as well. It's not the way it's going to be viewed, though, by the West, is it? And it's not the way, it's not going to be reported like that by Western media, I don't imagine.
No, of course. But I don't think Putin cares much how the West is seeing it at this point. What he cares about is the sustainability, is the stability of his regime inside Russia. And the main pillar of this regime is that image of Putin protecting Russians from any kind of war coming to their porch. And that harks back to the events of the Chechen war, when Chechen insurgents staged daring attacks inside Moscow, the Tatar siege in Moscow, and also the attack on the school in Beslan. They were also blamed for blowing up apartment blocks inside Moscow in 1999. So Putin, what he showed is, again, an ability to protect people, to prevent civil war, which Russians, especially in this situation of a major conflict with the West, consider as a realistic possibility. So even if he comes across as somewhat weak, the fact that civil war has been averted trumps all other considerations in the eyes of Russia, of the Russian public. And there is another aspect, which another pillar, another foundation of Putin's regime, which is the lack of alternative. There is this famous Russian political meme, who else if not Putin? It pertains to the lack of alternative, or rather to the fact, to a perception that every alternative to Putin will be much, much worse than Putin himself. And of course, Prigozhin, with his image of a murderous thug, he fits into this mindset quite neatly. Majority of Russians definitely don't want somebody like Prigozhin to replace Putin at the end of the day.
No, they don't. But one of the other interesting aspects of the media coverage, and certainly of the commentary that we saw unfold on social media, was that all of a sudden on Saturday, Prigozhin was, he had an extraordinary makeover. He became a hero. He became somebody who could save the world from Putin and more to the point, stop the war in Ukraine, which is something that I found personally extraordinary to see on social media. But there it was. Did you see it as well? Did you notice that strain of thought?
Well, I did notice that strain of thought, and it lasted for some hours, I guess. But later, government officials in the West expressed much more caution and restraint in assessing this situation. But yeah, of course, the people who have been always active in promoting the idea of defeating Russia militarily in Ukraine completely and toppling the Putin and precipitating a breakup of Russia at the end of the day. Yes, they were hailing, they were very cheerful. about Prigozhin starting this mutiny. So there was a lot of wishful thinking. And when supporters of Prigozhin gathered in Rostov, several dozen or several hundred young, thuggish-looking men who were cheering Prigozhin, they interpreted this as a broad public support of Prigozhin in Russia, which, of course, it wasn't. So, and it were Western hawks, but mostly Eastern European politicians and commentators. One peculiar personality who joined this choir was Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the exiled Russian oligarch who essentially called on Russians to join the mutiny to support Prigozhin. But from the point of view of emigre Russians, this is a political suicide. Associating yourself with Prigozhin and also calling for civil war in Russia, that's a way to alienate yourself from the broad Russian audience.
Yes, it was quite an extraordinary call to Russians to hold their nose and support Prigozhin. One of the other things I think that has been noticeable out of all of this is the reaction of the Russian media. Now, from the limited amount that I've seen, it seems that there has been a degree of concern and criticism of the way this whole thing was handled in the Russian media itself, which is something that we haven't seen for a very long time, a couple of years at least, in the Russian media. Have you noticed any discernible change in the way the Russian media is reporting Putin and his handling of this affair?
Well, I'm not sure about this, because soon after the start of the full-out aggression, and especially after the first setbacks in Ukraine, Putin's administration itself created this situation of a relative pluralism in the media coverage of this war. But this pluralism was quite narrow. It was a pluralism for the pro-war faction. So the dispute about how Russia should be waging the war went into the open quite some time ago. It went into the open maybe in the summer of 2022. And that's when all the many Telegram channels appeared. Telegram channels now account for 18% of the Russian audience. 18% of Russians, according to a Levada poll, use Telegram as the main source of information. So, and this is the premium audience. This is the most politically active audience in Russia.
It doesn't really matter what mainstream Russian media says.
Well, it does and it doesn't. The mainstream Russian media, and by that we mean television primarily, is catering to the conformist majority. The majority whose support of Putin is conditional, but also a majority that has been apathetic for the last 20 years. So the purpose of a television propaganda from Kremlin's point of view is for this conformist majority to remain apathetic. However, it is just as important for Putin to control the proactive minority, a politically active minority, which is also a very large force. And in a situation of a political upheaval, the most important thing is who controls this politically active minority, not the passive majority, which probably will continue to be passive and will just watch this upheaval to unfold. So in that sense, it is important that Putin try to create the situation in which different factions in the pro-war party were fighting each other bitterly. But of course, with this mutiny by Prigozhin, who himself controlled many of these channels and a media empire of sorts, it went into the open and it resulted in this major political earthquake.
A final question, Leonard, if I might. One of the other aspects of this story that I think I am personally surprised has not gotten more play, certainly in Western media, was Prigozhin saying that the Kremlin stated reason for starting this war, that, you know, NATO was encroaching into its traditional sphere of influence, was rubbish. That was not true. That is the narrative that the West has used to criticize the Kremlin for a year and a half. Yet here we have, you know, somebody who is quite senior in the overall military hierarchy saying exactly that. But the Western media doesn't appear to have picked up on it as strongly as you might have thought. Has that surprised you at all?
No, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, it's of course an endless dispute why things are happening in Russia the way they are happening. In my personal opinion, this is to a large extent due to the fact that instead of serving as an arbiter between different countries in Eastern Europe, the West chose to be a party in the conflict and basically instead of trying to integrate Russia into NATO and European Union back in the 1990s, it chose this salami tactics of cutting away slices of former Russian sphere of influence. And people like Lushkov and Evgeny Primakov were warning back in the 1999 that as a result of these tactics, Russian leadership, the Russian political regime will become more authoritarian and there'll be essentially more conflict with the West. So much of what is happening in Russia and with Russia is being driven by this conflict. It's part of the logic of the conflict in which both sides are escalating at some point, both sides crossing those proverbial red lines. And stepping up confrontation. It's the Kremlin is of course using the conflict with the West in order for Putin to retain power. The conflict is the reason why Putin is still in power. So there is a bit of this of a symbiosis between Putin's regime and hawks of the West who, on the surface of it, are fighting Putin with all their might. But in actual fact, they are helping Putin to retain power.
Leonard, we'll leave it there. I thank you very much for your time, and we look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Thank you very much for having me.
And on that note, I'd like to thank Leonard Rogozin for being on Fourth Estate, and thanks for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so that you can hear us talk about media, politics and everything in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle there is Fourth Estate AU. Thanks to my producer, Anthony Dockrell. I'm Monica Attard, and thank you for listening.